Thank you, Robert, for the introduction. Now that you know I work so very hard over the weekend just to keep up with my neighbors, I appreciate your feedback if you have any on curry or you want to talk about back office. So let's talk about back office now. What is back office to you? We see back office as the administration and support of a company's public activities. So on a daily basis, a back office would be processing transactions and support the business to make sure that it runs smoothly. And for our presentation, we are only focusing on the back office in the financial services industry, in particular, wealth management. And that would cover superannuation funds, asset managers, and its directly related activities. So, who do you think is the front runner in administration? A big statement, I'd say. I know some of you are thinking, why Melbourne? But I'm actually more surprised that we actually declared that we like administration. Administration to me is a bit like housework. It's unglamorous. It's repetitive. It's labor intensive. And like housework, it is evil. It has got to be stopped. Hence, any innovation that we are actually talking in the back office or any innovation that's happening in the back office is really about making the process faster. Better. We're getting rid of unnecessary steps, and that is the focus of our presentation. We will look at how the back office has changed over the years. First, we will observe the changes in the industry in the last 10 years, and then we will look at how the back office has actually changed in terms of operational efficiency. Sean will talk more about the factors that's driving the change and what the future may hold. But before we go any further, let me share with you what I see as innovation. Well, aside from Vindaloo's, I like music. My mom has a collection of black vinyl records, and I have my own mountains of cassettes. And do you remember the cassette days? Six songs on the side, and then you have to flip it over. And the part where the part about untangling the ribbons with a pencil, and that is a pain. But thank goodness the CD player came along. No need to change over cassettes. You can play your favorite song again and again. But as the recording companies will have it, there's always only one good song on every CD, and you will end up carrying heaps of CDs around. So the new kid in town is that? Well, we all know it's Doors music. Thousands of it if you have it. The major change, of course, is it's Doors video. You can watch Gordon Ramsay, William Shatner, anytime, anywhere. And it's light, and it oozes style. And that is what I see as innovation. But Wikipedia defines innovation as a radical or incremental change in thinking, in things, in processes, in services. In the evolution of a music player, I think it is all that. But why do businesses want to innovate? As noted earlier, innovation is only innovation if it actually improves the process, that improves the outcome. The reasons are obvious. For any business, the focus has always been about increasing revenue. So to achieve all that, you actually have to increase or improve the user experience. You improve quality, the reliability, you give new features, and keeping the expenses low at the same time. And in the back office, the change must increase value for the business or for the customer. But innovation in the back office is not as visible as that we see in the music player industry. The changes has been incremental, and we will talk about it in the next few slides. So, what has changed? First, we will observe the changes in the industry. How was it like in 1998, and how is it today? Then we have a closer look at the back office. So, do you know what you were doing in 1998? The top movie at that time was Titanic. Well, I hope that wasn't too long ago for you. And over that 10 years, superannuation assets has actually tripled. And it has reached the $1 trillion mark in 2008. The steady stream of superannuation contributions that's coming into the industry is actually making it very profitable. Everyone wants their finger in the pot of honey. There are more fund managers, there are more IT providers, there are more administrators than ever before. And everyone is actually benefiting from it, except for the life office. With more players in the honeypot and recent disasters like Opus Prime, it's not unexpected that the regulators are actually working harder and with much greater intensity. But some things never change. We're all too familiar with the "please hold, your call is important to us" scenario. Even though call centers are using voice and communication technology like voice recognition to reduce costs and improve services, I still actually prefer to speak to a real person. So, how has the back office changed over the same period of time? As I mentioned earlier, any innovation in the back office is about making the process faster, better. And back office has been scanning and storing client correspondences on database for some time already. There's no more excuses for losing customer paperwork. But more importantly, anyone in the business can search through the database and have a good idea of the customer history with the company. For example, I have received a query from Sean about the unit prices on 1st of April. I looked up the system and see that Sean has a string of queries about unit prices. I would actually profile him as a very savvy investor. So when I dropped up a reply for him, well, I better be able to cover all his previous queries about tax accrual rates, about distributions. What is accrued in the unit price? Well, I better be as savvy as he is because I know he expects that. And other areas of innovation would be the move from manual work to automation on spreadsheets. And nowadays, systems are actually increasingly replacing spreadsheets. But that said, every department still have their own systems. A system for investment trading, for portfolio accounting, for administration, for performance. Endless hours of trying to reconcile data that you get from system A to system B. And this day, system integration is a norm. And there is actually technology out there to have one single system to replace all these other systems. And we believe that straight-through processing would be a reality one day. But that, by that, I mean an end-to-end process. Currently, a lot of super funds actually say that they do straight-through processing. But that is purely from a customer's perspective. Employer logs onto a website, they load the contribution file, they pay the money to the admin company or to the super fund, and it's loaded onto the administration system. And that's it. That's where the straight through ends. All the stuff in the back office will be running around like mice just to get the money out the door. And in fact, the process just to send the trading instructions to the banks is quite a fiddly process until the recent introduction of SwiftNet. Swift is a technology that has been around for a long time. In fact, if you have transferred monies from overseas, you would have been prompted to provide a Swift code that identifies the destination bank. Swift is actually a secure network that bank uses to communicate with each other. But a fund manager who wants to communicate with a bank, okay, they will have to rely for a specific method that the bank tells them to. And each bank will have their own format, and it's really, really time consuming just to get the communication done. And with SwiftNet, corporates can just communicate with any bank on the network. And that makes the back office processing a bit more efficient. You have less risk of getting it wrong, it's less costly to maintain, and it's facilitating more timely and better service. But is back office only about operational efficiency? Process improvement is a key element, but the reality is any change in process will impact other areas of the business. For example, if we look at unit prices, over the last decade, the volume of unit prices that we are computing has actually increased significantly. Calculations has moved from spreadsheets to specialist softwares these days. The availability of specialist softwares reflects the recognition of the risk of getting it wrong and the extra control that's actually in place to mitigate that risk. Another reason is the increase in outsourcing of unit pricing to specialists. But at the same time, the cumulative compensation has increased. The cumulative compensation arising from unit pricing errors has reached $1 billion in 2008. And it is no surprise that unit pricing has received heavy scrutiny from the regulators and at all levels of the organization. The risk of not monitoring is getting very costly. And the regulators even published a guide to help everyone better understand the intricacies and considerations around the unit pricing process and calculations. Hence, a successful innovation really relies on excellent implementation and ongoing monitoring. But still, people are innovating. And what is actually driving the back office to innovate? Sean will tell you more.
Thank you very much, Rachel. I don't like housework either, is it? We won on that. Now, Rachel's taken us through the pervasiveness of the changes in the last 10 years, and what we found quite fascinating was these things happen gradually. It's the incremental change, the incremental improvement all along that really is at the core of innovation in the back office in financial services. It's not the Apple iPod Touch type effect. It's the gradual, the piece by piece, so that you hardly notice it. But if any of it is taken away, then you really would notice it. And I'll just go ahead here, I think, through some of these slides. Yep. Okay. So given that, what have been the drivers of change leading to innovation? I think what's interesting in this is that it's a thin line between the drivers of innovation and the symptoms or the facilitators. They're very much interlinked, and there's a lot of interaction. There's a lot of pulling and pushing between these things. And as we go through them, I think you'll think of examples of where that's the case. Super legislation is a huge one. The contributory up to 9% from 3% compulsory contributions is critical. Rachel showed you the numbers. You know, we're up to 1.2 trillion and heading higher. And that is bringing an enormous amount of interest, to put it mildly, in the industry. And it's providing the critical mass for entities to experiment, to be different. And that runs right through all the rest of the themes here. Competition in a whole different range of ways. Globalization is a critical one in there, where you do have comparisons of best practice from region to region, identification of what one jurisdiction does well being carried through to another one. And the speed of implementation, you know, there's more transparency. Competition drives those things and is aided by them as well. Things like the strategic decisions by banks to get into wealth management a decade ago, you know, has had a big effect in terms of the one, a size of entities, and two, a willingness to invest capital in financial services, at the non-bank financial services, and develop products and be fairly aggressive in the marketplace. at the end of the day, that diversification and that scale helps. On the technology side, it's probably the biggest influence of all in terms of a facilitator. We have the web. You know, 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago, in 1999, I was presenting a paper to the Institute in Darwin on internet strategies for financial services companies. Yeah, and I had a look at that while we were preparing this, and it's just amazing how far we've come in those 9 years. All my predictions came true, of course. But it is quite interesting to see those directions. You know, we've got Web 2 now. You know, many of you will have MySpace or Facebook accounts, and you're downloading videos and all the rest of it. And we take that for granted in so many ways. But that the equivalent of that in the business end of things is that you do have the capability to do internet banking to the extent that it is done, to do online lookups of exactly what your account value is today rather than yesterday. It's incredibly pervasive. And there's a lot has happened behind the scenes to make those things happen. There's middleware in companies where those old legacy systems that I was talking about in the previous session are being tagged into by various IT systems and pulling out the relevant bits and pieces that can be presented. Those things are going on in the background, and you know, most of us don't see it. Speed, direct access by individuals, by the beneficiaries is great. Economic boom, you know, it's been an amazing 10 years, and even last week with the budget, we still have to find ways to hide away all this extra money that's coming in so that we don't spend it. There's just so much of it around. Individual wealth has increased, you know, and in financial services and wealth management, we get a tremendous gearing from that, even apart from the compulsory superannuation side. All of that puts more money into the system. All of it, too, leads to an increase in sophistication, too. Regulation. The bigger the pot, the more that can go wrong, the bigger the risks, the more risk of fraud, the more risk of just making mistakes, the higher operational risks, and the more interest everybody has in what's being done and that it's done transparently and it's done properly. So regulation itself is both a driver and sometimes a follower of change. Consumer protection ties in with regulation. There are expectations out there from consumers. There are consumer bodies which promote and lobby industry and lobby the government for that angle on things. And as actuaries, I think our history is very much in being fair and equitable to policyholders. So that comes through as well. There's more and more specialization. The numbers that Rachel had up there of software providers, for instance, you know, in the 10 years it went from, it was 10 or 15, that order of magnitude, up to 100, 105, 109. That's just enormous. And you know, of those 10, there's probably about six of those firms still around. And the rest are, a lot of them are specialists. Some of them, of course, are big software developers that have gone overseas. Companies like Bravura, for instance, you know, they're ASX 300 companies, and they're doing amazing things in software. And there's a lot of money, a lot of time in development. And those and other companies like them are developing specialist products. There's, for example, products like software which monitors change in performance on a daily basis. Now, those sorts of products just weren't there before. And it's partly demand, but it also helps in keeping our industry well-regulated, well-functioning, well-monitored, because those monitorings can now go on within entities themselves, and there's more rigor and there's more due process happening. Product innovation. If you look at the investment side of things and the range of products that have emerged over the last few years, some might say for the worse in some instances because they weren't understand, but that's sort of perhaps people going too far in the sense of losing a touch of common sense, perhaps, in investing in things that they don't understand with. But that's the industry. It's buyer beware is the principle underlying it. And those things are happening because the market is there. People find a niche, companies find a niche. And there is increasing consumer sophistication through all of that, although sometimes there's a lag in that naturally. The market can fire ahead. So where do we go from here? What we thought would be interesting would be to try and identify future areas of innovation. And to do that, we thought we'd look at some key themes and facilitators. The most striking is technology, and I did talk about that already, so I won't spend much longer on that. Essentially, though, it is all about embracing the technology that's there, the web, the IT firms that specialize in software products which make the processes more efficient. Sometimes there's innovation in the processes themselves, too. Sometimes it's new products. Sometimes it's business process re-engineering. Sometimes it's the whole business of outsourcing. You know, 10 years ago, how much was actually outsourced to third parties? That's quite a change. And that requires stronger control. Sometimes it brings a discipline. If it works well, it has all the benefits of discipline plus efficiency, cost efficiency. We do have a global village. Good ideas and successful implementations are implemented around the world. Examples of that, I think, are the platforms that we have here, which are being introduced to the UK. We've got a platform like Navigator, for instance, being promoted by Aviva in Singapore. They're examples of homegrown initiative ideas, real innovation that are going around the world. And because we have the critical mass here, we can do that. Looking to the future, let's just have a little play, a little challenge to our minds. What we've done here is just extrapolate in true actuarial fashion from the previous slides. but it's not a straight line extrapolation, so we have thought a bit about it. what I'd like you to do is not so much worry about the actual numbers that we have here, but encourage you to go through the thought process of thinking from your perspective, where you are in your organization, where do you see the future in 10 years' time? Where do you see innovation bringing you? And remembering that innovation is incremental, it is improvement in process, it is improvement in your way of doing things, as well as ultimately having an outcome which means that one or more people, be they consumers or be they entities, are actually better off. Now, the only thing we can be sure about these predictions is that they're wrong, because we might be actuaries, but we're not astrologists, so we can't actually see into the future. We can just give our best estimate, and there's volatility around those numbers. These are educated guesses. Essentially, I suppose, if we look at the superannuation assets, that's probably the easiest thing to determine. It will be around $3 or $4 trillion in 10 years' time. And that means that all the drivers that we've seen earlier will continue to come through. So I think a lot of that will be continuation. The life of a share, even though it'll probably still decline, but that's... you can't just look at the 10% there. The actual dollar figures of funds under management are actually higher than that. And, of course, most life companies have lots of business that's not through the traditional life office areas. So that's not a worry if you're from a life office. Fund managers, we think the numbers of players will continue to increase, but there'll be not quite to the same extent, because we'd expect some mergers and acquisitions to happen, and the pure scale of things will be big too. Similar for the software providers, and the administrators will probably expand less because economies of scale there are more critical, and some of those companies may become very, very big indeed and partner with more people, and the bigger you get, you do get the benefit then of being able to provide scale. And we've seen some examples of that in the investment custodian businesses. And I think as Australia builds that capital pool or the pool of assets, that increasingly there'll be opportunities worldwide for that expertise to go offshore on the outsourcing side, even if some of it is through IT support in Bangalore. That's just part of the equation. There is a lot of expertise here. And increasingly we have international players coming to Australia, and we've seen that again on the investment side. That tends to be the first area where people come in and offer products. But in back office, support, etc., that no doubt will come over the next 10 years as well. Okay, I won't say anything further about these elements because it really is just an extrapolation from before. The regulation is probably worth one comment, and you know, I've said international there. The regulatory agencies around the world increasingly talk to each other and talk to each other regularly and very often too, and in a more and more organised way. You know, who knows whether there'll be a single regulator here within Australia in 10 years' time or not, but you know, it comes up probably about every 10 years for good discussion, and you just don't know. It is the UK model. And of course, we're all still human, and we still do like the personal touch, and we have to remember that all the way through. So the innovation is not necessarily about automating everything. It is about making the experience for the end user more pleasurable, better service, and of course more cost effective internally. So looking to the future, there's a few core areas here that are worth considering. I think the integration side, and Rachel alluded to this when she was talking about straight through processing, which is the second big element. There is still the capacity to have your straight-through processing happening across functions within entities. And that integration across business functions, I think, will be a big theme coming over the next 10 years or so. There's been a lot of automation, a lot of cost-effectiveness, governance processes within particular functions and entities. The increasing use of outsourcing has specialized that to some degree, but there is a lot of capacity to now get the benefit across functions. And the technology is improving all the time. Companies are getting practice at doing it internally within a function. It's only a matter of time. Straight through processing. Wouldn't it be nice if you just clicked on your superannuation fund screen to say, okay, pay me such and such a benefit, I want to go, and that you didn't have to wait a few weeks for it to come through. So the capabilities are there, and the integration needs to happen, but that will happen because they're very, very, very time-consuming processes, and there's a lot of elements like taxation and values and the like that have to be worked out. It's just a matter of putting them together. So there are some examples. I think ultimately we do live in a sense a me society. Everything is geared towards the individual. We already have, and for the last 10 years, we've had instances of companies talking about a target market of one. And what we now expect will happen is that target market of one will be reversed around the other way, so that the consumer, as you or I, can actually choose what we want to do, and that will drive some of the offerings. And as people get more financially savvy over time, there'll be increased demand for that. Enhanced business partnering. I've touched on this a bit with the outsourcing. Where outsourcing has worked, it's been where there's been strong partnering between an entity and the company that's, you know, doing its administration or doing its IT. And really, it's part of one logistic stream. And that integration is about getting to know each other's businesses and really being part of that and being part of the strategic planning going forward. So that partnering is going to increase as we go forward. And that's across technology. It might be business processing. Distribution with advisors is a very good example where with the offerings, particularly on the retail side, say with platforms, where the advisors are, you know, they're in that logistics stream already and very dependent on the on those platforms for their information, and they've got direct access to the client's records. So expect to see that extending out through the other areas of financial services. And of course, it's global. It's not just in Australia, and you'll get a lot of partnering like that, which will give people scale going forward. So to summarize, we've seen massive innovation in the last 10 years, but it hasn't been obvious. And it's only when you stop and look back and see and look under the cover, in effect, to see what's actually been going on. Quite fascinating, actually. Innovation does improve the experience, which is critical. It's all about outcomes. Innovation's got to improve the outcomes, or it's not innovation. The drivers are wide-ranging and continuing, and we look to the future and sort of themes that may emerge there. And it is much easier to observe than to do. Now, I'll finish up with a little story. And it's some of you may have heard this already, but every morning in Africa, a gazelle wakes up, and it knows it must run faster than any lion in order to stay alive, to survive. Every morning a lion wakes up, it knows it must outrun the slowest gazelle for it to survive, or it'll starve to death. And it doesn't matter whether you're a lion or a gazelle, when the sun comes up, if you're not running, you won't survive. So innovate or perish. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Sean. We now have about 20 minutes to have a discussion. So both Sean and Rachel mentioned a number of issues there, looking both back into the past and into the future. And we're quite keen to get other people's views on what they see as the important innovations that have happened or that may happen, or if you've got any questions at all that you have for Sean or Rachel, things that you'd like them to expand on. Now, as with all of these sessions, we do have a microphone. Luckily, I think we've got a roving one here. So I'll if you've got a question, put your hand up and I'll come around. You can say your name at the start. So who would like to kick off?
Hello? Yes? Working? I think so. Margaret Bishop from BNP Paribas. From our point of view, as an administrator, I'd say the one thing I've noticed both at BNP Paribas and before when I was consulting to custodians is that custodians in particular, and probably most administrators, suffer from a lack of funds. I mean, no one wants to pay an administrator because it's non-sexy, as was mentioned before. And so there's always a great list of things that they want to do, and technology has made so much possible, but either from a lack of funds or just the lack of resources in the market, there's only so much you can do at one time. So I'd probably note that some of those drivers for innovation have also been things that would hold innovation back, particularly the economic boom. It's taken resources, IT resources, be a classic at the moment, away into every area. You know, every business is looking for IT resources, and you can only do, even if you've got a wad of money, you can only hire so many people. And this, I guess, the second point that I wanted to make, just referring back to the housework analogy that you made, I wonder if we could come up with something as innovative as the Enyo house cleaning products, which I think you can pay about $200 for a broom. If administrators could come up with something similar to that, then we'd have no problem with funds. So Enyo's made housework sexy and expensive, so maybe we can think of some way of doing that for administration as well.
Margaret Cantwell. Just a bit of background. I work at Westpac Life in New Zealand, and I guess we have potentially what might be a unique administration system in that we are very much part of the bank, but we outsource all our product administration to an organisation which specialises in funds management administration. So where we have found some of our biggest pieces of efficiency around our operations has been where we have taken bits of expertise from those three types of organisations and meshed them together to speed up our processes from an internal back office perspective, and some of that has been really fantastic. Also, I think on the other side, some of the challenges for us have been the different cultures within a bank, an insurance company and a funds management company, and the way they think about things, and contracting to get the best levels of service from our external third-party administration company.
Sorry, I didn't give you either you two a chance to comment on either of the previous speakers.
I didn't offer to comment because they're excellent excellent comments. I don't think I can add anything to that. And I think we'd have a preference to hear people's views. You know, if you want to ask us a specific question, that's fine. But the idea of this is really a forum to exchange views.
Okay. Does anyone else have a view, you think?
Kelvin Prusk. I was at an APEC forum earlier this year, and we were looking at regulation issues around the APEC region. And what came through to me in that was what's going on in India in particular, where we all know about Indian IT. They are now heading down the financial services line in a big way, and it will be, and some of the solutions are way outside the dimension we've ever thought of. One of the things they are seriously looking at is a single entry point for all worker superannuation, that it would be driven from a single entry point. Now, it's sort of mind-boggling, just the sheer size of what this is going to be about. But I'm quite convinced they're going to make it work. And I think some of the flow-on effects that we will see from that innovation are going to drive we're going to need to react to a lot of change as a result of that. So just that.
I think the whole question of India as a, I suppose, the primary example of an English-speaking country where the services that we offer, ultimately, if we want to get to the very sharp point of it, is fascinating, and there's a whole bunch of things at play there. I mean, I've talked to companies. From say the Philippines, for instance, you know, where they're here in Melbourne, promoting their business process, offshoring in effect. So these things are they're all going on as we speak, even though we've really only seen in a major way the IT side actually interacting with the back offices. But there is a lot going on. Would anybody like to make a comment about that aspect? Maybe it's a little controversial, perhaps, but becoming, I think, very much less so as time goes by.
Yeah.
One of the things I've noticed is that obviously a lot of companies are looking at India and other locations to relocate business. But having I've worked around a few different places in the last 10 years. I started off in Melbourne, and then I went to the UK, and then I came back to Sydney. And the one thing I noticed in the UK was that all of the big life offices didn't have any sizable office in London at all. They'd all outsourced to a reasonably nearby big town, which was easily accessible by train and so on, and it had the advantage that people who couldn't afford to live in London could actually have quite a good lifestyle in a large town in the UK countryside. I came back to Sydney, and it was pretty much the start of the push here to moving everything straight off to Asia. And I thought, why can't we move people to Geelong or Newcastle or Wollongong, which are, you know, a lot of, I mean, where I work, a lot of people actually already live halfway to Newcastle because they can't afford to live in Sydney. So I had this discussion recently with, I can't remember who it was, but someone who basically said they were moving part of their business off to India, and they said, I said, well, why don't you just move it to Newcastle or something? And they said, well, in India, we've got probably 10 university qualified graduates for every one that we would have here. And they're more highly qualified than the people we're going to, you know, here we will probably be getting high school graduates or even possibly year 11 for the same sort of thing. But I guess I still wonder if we're missing some part of our own community that we should be thinking about here, and you know, what are our people going to do when there's no more jobs like this left in Australia? And perhaps there are some advantages that we're overlooking that are of benefit in moving people just 3 hours or 1.5 hours away rather than half the world away. So I just wonder if anyone else has any sort of similar views to that.
Guy Horton. I work in Thailand. I think you've got only a little while longer to run through this sort of sending things off to Asia for a while. We find that our IT staff cost is increasing by about 12% a year, which is significantly higher, I imagine, than the rate of growth here in Australia. I think China's is running at about 40% a year at the moment. I think India's running at something like 15% a year, 20% a year. And they're experiencing turnover rates probably in the order of 30% a year of their staff. So what you're finding is, I think it's just it's like opening a lock. The water's flowing in. Things are going to continue for a while, and then there's going to be an equilibrium reached. That equilibrium may be a fair way away. There is 1 billion people who can pick up IT skills in one of the countries, and when they're finished, there's another 1 billion in the other country. So let's imagine it's a rather large lock. But it means that things that used to look like an obvious equation, Vietnam's another one. Vietnam was an obvious one. Of course we'd relocate a factory there. We can hire people for $1 an hour. Well, you could, and then you started finding that those people say, well, actually, my cost of living has gone up. Rice has gone up fivefold in the last 5 years, from $200 a tonne to $1,000 a tonne. So in Thailand right now, we've seen the government just announce special mid-year price wage increases for all government staff, and they've encouraged all the private sector to follow, as opposed to most governments who encourage you not to increase because it follows a wage price spiral. They've encouraged everybody to follow suit. And those price rises, those salary increases mid-year are 6% for all staff in the country. That's 6% on top of the 10% we gave all our staff at the end of last year. So that's 16% in about 8 months. So what you find is things are changing. It means that what used to be a low-cost country is no longer becoming that way. What used to be the low-cost country is becoming a medium-cost country. So I think maybe it presents two positive, too positive a view to imagine that that's going to be, you know, 2 years from now it'll all be fine and no one will be outsourcing. No. But it means that the enormous differentiation that has allowed this kind of offshoring to be seen as this magic thing is reversing perhaps a lot more rapidly than people had imagined. So people thought that they would offshore to India and they would have 20 years of expense gains. Perhaps isn't quite what they imagined. And that, in fact, the difference will be made up faster. And the more people do it, obviously, the faster the difference gets bridged. So you find in most of these countries, people see an overall situation. They see salary increases in India. I think the average last year was 9%. But that's 9%, including one hell of a lot of farm workers and factory workers who are not getting 9% increases. They're getting 3% increases, while 10% of the economy is probably getting 20% increases. So you've seen two economies in, I think, Vietnam, Thailand, India, and even in China, I think, where you're finding that the situation overall is hiding what's happening to skilled workers versus unskilled workers, the new economy versus the old. And when those countries get full, probably Laos and Cambodia will come online. But at the end of the day, things will come to much more equilibrium where people will have other costs offsetting it. So the costs of corruption, the costs of lack of rule of law, the costs of poor infrastructure, and combined with a staff cost that's not hugely different, or the introduction of additional staff benefits like pension plans that never were the case, people want healthcare, things like that, will start to make a difference. In that case, the question is, can you make a quality difference with it? And so maybe the difference is getting smaller than people had imagined it was. And I think 5 years ago is a very different situation to today. And we find that some of the things that are outsourced to China, which includes actuarial skills, they find that their cost base has increased 100% in 2 years. So I think the skilled labour thing is happening not just with IT, with actuarial, with other things. So you may not have that much longer that you have such a competition difference.
Thanks, Guy. I think you're absolutely right, and I've certainly noticed those numbers coming through on India too. I think it's very interesting, if we go back to our opening slide and, you know, Melbourne being world's best practice, there's a lot there that can be built on, and I think even to look at the development of Melbourne in the last 5-6 years, in particular as the industry funds being based here, partly historical, partly too because of the lower cost here relative to Sydney. And those things have now got a critical mass, so there is something to build on there. And if we can keep the efficiencies, there is a lot to be said for having the local expertise, having the access to it, having that integration between those business partners and the primary businesses. So that there are a lot of advantages as well.
Yeah. We've got the bell, so we might be able to have one or two more.
Hi, Jenny Sparks, I'm from Japan. Just to Guy's point and also the point Margaret raised, we have an ongoing project that's been going on for 3 years now, and it's called the Nearshoring Offshoring Project. And it is looking at both those options, both putting things in China and India, and we've had some good experiences and some bad experiences, the good being cheaper costs, the bad being a quality one, and for us, a language one. And nearshoring, putting things out of Tokyo, which is extremely expensive, down to Nagasaki, Kobe, other places around Japan that are a lot cheaper. So I think it's very much a case of looking at everything that you've got to do and saying, what's the best location for all of these, looking forward as well, looking at costs, looking at quality, looking at where the resources are and moving jobs to resources. So that's on that point. A question, particularly for Sean. Given massive innovation over the last 10 years, but you say you only notice it when you look back, now that you're here looking back, if you look at some of the less developed countries that are going to go through all of this, and looking at the point that was raised about there's never enough time to do everything, what would be the first thing that you would have started doing to innovate?
I think I'll answer the question, I suppose, perhaps in an indirect way. The advantage that other places have is that they can skip a lot of the
the trial and error and can go straight to solutions. My experience, having come from Ireland and seeing the changes in that economy, and it went from a third world is a bit disparaging and that's unfair, but it went from a, you know, it never went through the industrial age, it went straight from the agrarian age to the information age. And what that meant was that they could pick up the latest in technology and skip the intermediate parts. And that's what I would see happening with other countries. They look around the world and they have enough of a global perspective to do that and see what is best around the world and then take that and implement it. I don't think there really is a first thing you'd want to do. If I'm to pick something, it's probably the automation, using the technology, but using it where it has been used effectively, as opposed to don't be on the bleeding edge, be on the next level after that. See what's worked, that's tried and tested, and then access that software and the support for it. And implement that. So I hope that gives you a bit of a feel for my reaction.
We might be able to squeeze in one more. Has anyone got a last comment or example? Or?
Ian Moore. I had a recent experience. I was involved in a project where there was IT work being done in Sydney, North America and India. When it worked well, worked extremely well, issues could be worked on around the clock. Quick turnaround, but the possibilities for misunderstandings, miscommunication escalate, and it's a bit of a two-edged sword. And another quick comment on the driver, the recent investment volatility. Personally, I found that made me very conscious of which products I'm in, with which suppliers, where I could change things very easily and quickly, which ones I couldn't. It certainly influences sort of future intentions to where to put money and which products to get out of and so on. So there's another driver there.
That's it. I think the bell will go very soon. I don't know, Sean, whether you want to, and Rachel, you want to, that's the last opportunity to get the last word in? No? Sure? Okay. We will end it there. If you could, Rachel and Sean, thank you very much on behalf of everyone. If I just show the two of them your thanks. And also.